Welcome to Blind Faith. This is a podcast where we explore thoughts about God and life in this world. We highlight here how all scholarship is biography. This means it's our experiences and our situatedness where the questions we ask about God bubble up from. And that's where we then come to our thoughts, our thinking about God, our words about God. And that's what we're going to do in this. My name is Andy Opie.
My name is Paige Pester.
My name is Salma Kettner.
And we're going to do this together. And I was just thinking today about one of my experiences. And as we talk about disability theology throughout this podcast, one of my experiences early on with blindness and losing my eyesight was visiting a friend down in San Diego. And we were walking through Pacific Beach on the way to coffee or lunch. I forget what. We were walking through and a couple of like 10, 11-year-old kids were skateboarding as we cross an intersection. And then they just pop up and see me walking with my cane. And they blurt out, "Hey, does it suck to be blind?" As I'm walking across the street and I'm thinking, how do I answer that question? Yeah. I'm like, yes and no and all kinds of things in between.
Right.
So I don't even know, what would you say if you're in that situation?
Yeah, I guess yes and no and all the things in between.
I would be speechless, honestly.
Yeah.
Oh, I just appreciate, though, I appreciate kids because they'll ask the things that we lose that sensibility as we get older to ask those questions of curiosity. So it can be really funny, but it's also like super precious that people ask curious questions when they're kids and they stop asking them when they get older. Do you have any thoughts of when, or memories of when somebody asks you a silly question?
Man, I don't know. I think there was one time I was in a grocery store with my my daughter, and she was looking at somebody who was in front of us, and they were in a wheelchair and just kind of struggling at the checkout line. And she kind of pointed at the wheelchair, you know, and kind of was like, "What is that?" Or, you know, and the lady, you know, was kind and just, you know, sort of said, you know, "Oh, it's how I get around. I use it to get around." And I was, you know, probably like 10 shades of red, just trying to like have the words go back into her mouth and didn't know how to react. And my daughter just kind of looked at her and looked at me, and she just kind of went, "Cool." And that was the end of it. And I was like, all right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I have anything that comes to mind. But I remember being the kid that would ask like those silly questions. And now that you're older, it is true. You kind of lose that curiosity. So I feel like I'm always trying to find ways to get some of that curiosity back and to ask questions.
Well, I hope we can foster that curiosity as we continue on these, on this podcast journey. But we are excited that we get to have a session today with Ben Connor, where we got to ask a number of questions and let the curiosity go where it went as we asked him about his journey in disability theology and the things that he's done and reflected on. So we're going to transition to that now.
I was stuck in a labyrinth, called it a palace. He brought me out and gave me eyes to see all my lonely tower, my misspent hours. You filled them with flowers in ways I can't
All right, let's welcome Dr. Ben Connor, Benjamin Connor, here to this conversation as we continue to explore disability theology. I just want to introduce him kind of organically here. He's a professor at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan. So I always laugh internally, Western Theological Seminary, Western of what? What part of, what is it west of versus east of? Because there's so many Westerns in this country, or Northwesterns, or schools that are geographically located. But that's just a funny thing that doesn't have anything to do with introducing who you are. But I super appreciate the work that Dr. Connor has done on disability and ministry and overseeing, maybe I'm not saying it right, but working with a doctorate in ministry, I think, as well as a master's in disability ministry, working in the disability and ministry program there for a long, long time. And being involved with the Summer Institute over the years, Summer Institute of Theology and Disability, and reflecting on this question. I know more recently you've moved on to other questions besides disability, but you've contributed a lot to the conversation on disability studies and disability and the church and disability theology. So just want to welcome you with that short little introduction. I got to know your work as I was doing my PhD studies, and it was really refreshing and exciting to read. I learned a new word in a review of your work, and that was it was the word trialogue, and that was the reviewer in the International Bulletin of Mission Research saying what you did was a trialogue between disability, mission, and theological education. And I just maybe got excited about learning new words as I learned how others received your work. But it was exciting to me as I started to study disability and maybe the questions of why I study disability were big on me, because, oh, am I going to then get labeled? Oh, you are disabled and you're the disability guy, and disability is marginalized enough, and do I want to go down that road? But I do want to ask you about how you got into it, and then I'll circle back to what really encouraged me in some of even the first pages of your book. Your book, Disabling Mission and Enabling Witness, I should probably make sure I foreground that. A very meaningful book, and I still think it's very worth people reading and pushing the conversation forward from things that you said. But it felt like, as I read it, and maybe a little bit wrong perspective from my side, but it felt like it was a culmination of many years of you working in disability ministry, both in the work you did alongside your teaching role as a professor, but working with the ministry there in Holland, Michigan, and so on, and so it just felt like it's something that came out of something you lived. But I'd love to hear more of just what brought you into working with disability ministry, and then even theological inquiry or to ask questions that would turn into a book on this topic.
Well, absolutely. First of all, thanks for having me. And I'm glad that you decided to lean into your embodiment as a site out of which you theologize explicitly, because you're doing it anyways. You may as well be explicit about it. And the Blind Faith podcast and your dissertation, from what I've read of it, demonstrate that you're bringing an important perspective to this conversation. So thank you for the work you're doing, and thanks for having me. So how did I get into this? Well, I'd just been accepted to study missional and ecumenical theology at Princeton Theological Seminary with Daryl Guter.
Let me pause you right there, just because maybe people here or who are hearing this might not get as excited as I might to hear what you're saying, but Daryl Guter, really well known for his book, Missional Church, and really groundbreaking work helping so many in the idea of missional church and giving theological roots to something that maybe a lot of practitioners, even maybe some of the grandchildren of his work, maybe don't realize all of what he brought to it. But that's a really big deal to get to do that. So maybe share a little bit more of who that is and what Princeton Theological Seminary is, because in the places where I run, Princeton's maybe highly respected, but maybe not known as well. So say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So Princeton Theological Seminary has a great history of being involved with missiologists who are at the forefront of the ecumenical movement. Even some of their buildings are named after those folks. And when Daryl Guter came to the seminary, he took on the role with some funding from the Luce Foundation of the only chair of missional and ecumenical theology. Now, the word missional exists, as we understand today, because of the work of Daryl Guter and George Hunsberger and a couple of other folks who recovered this term. But when I say recovered it, it's really more of a neologism. Like, it's really a word. It makes no sense to go back in history and to see how it was used, because the way that they're using it is in a polemical sense. In other words, they're critiquing the idea that the church has a mission, and they're saying that God has a mission and the church participates in mission. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that discipleship is participation in the ongoing redemptive work of God in the world through the Holy Spirit. And, theology isn't an exercise of people sitting around a fireplace thinking about how we make sense of God. It's an active response to the world, trying to explain the things of faith to the world. So mission in that sense is the mother of theology. And the church exists to support this ongoing redemptive mission. So mission is the mother of the church. And so this whole collection of documents that we have is scripture, was pulled together, not as an interesting historical document, but support a community to have a more faithful witness in the world. So mission is the mother of the Bible. So that's the whole idea behind missional theology. And ecumenical theology just identifies the fact that all of our theologizing is local and perspectival and limited. And we need to be in conversation with other people from other cultures, with other embodiments and other experiences, to have a fuller understanding of what this gospel is, the very gospel that we're committed to and that we're proclaiming in our witness. And as we participate in that with other people, we come to understand it more deeply, grow more committed to it, and see all these various nuances. So that's why I went to Princeton, and I went to study with the guy who really generated the conversation through grants and bringing people together and through publications.
Yeah, yeah.
He was near and dear to my heart already, because I had read Be My Witnesses, which was his first book, which was written to support the way that book came to be. What he was doing, training for Young Life staff. And I imagine your listeners would be familiar with Young Life.
Yeah, yeah.
An evangelical organization that tries to reach unchurched youth with the gospel, that now also has a Young Life Capernaum, which is intentionally reaching out to young people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So he was writing training for Young Life staff on how to think about Christian witness and how the practice of evangelism fits within this larger understanding of Christian witness, martyria, you know, witness, martyria, the idea that the martyrs give their life and their blood, and that is their testimony to their belief in Christ and in Jesus and in the Spirit and God. And so our martyria, our witness, there's a doing of it, which is our diaconia, or our service, our deacons. There's a saying of it, our proclamation, our kerygma.
Yep, yep.
And there's a being of it, the kind of community we are that is a proclamation of the very gospel that we're proclaiming, and that's our how do you like it when words escape you? That's our fellowship, our koinonia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Koinonia. So all those things together are the setting in which our evangelism is situated. And so that I was getting ready. So I just gotten accepted to study. I was getting ready to leave, and I had a habit or a tradition of reading to my son before he goes to bed in a love seat.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 7 years old at the time. And I don't remember what we were reading, but what I remember vividly is that as I was reading to him, his eyes rolled back and he had a seizure. Now, already at seven, we had decided to homeschool him because we realized that he didn't learn like other children. He needed to be in perpetual motion. He was a kinesthetic learner. He needed to manipulate things. He needed to solve things and figure them out for himself. He couldn't read well because of visual tracking issues. So he had to listen instead of reading. Often he'd do that on a trampoline or on a scooter or just bouncing back and forth in the house. So actually I was already learning a whole lot about pedagogy, you know, how one teaches, how one elicits learning. And honestly, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was learning about universal design and learning.
Mm-hmm.
I was learning that I need multiple modes of presenting information. And I was learning that my son needed to be able to demonstrate his learning in a way that made sense to him. So I had to have multiple modes in which he could demonstrate his competency in whatever we were learning. So already I knew that something was up with my son. And when the seizure happened, we took him to the ER and went through all these tests and, you know, pediatric neurologist, MRI, CAT scan, occupational therapist, physical therapist, vision therapist, unusual woman with herbs, like anything we could do to try to figure out how to make sense of what was going on. But the issue was he had had a stroke at birth and was missing a third of his brain.
Oh.
But he was making all these connections and understanding things in ways that didn't make sense to us. For example, we had a screensaver at the time that was DOS codes.
Mm-hmm.
And he memorized the DOS codes, got out of Windows, and created some sort of DOS program. And I didn't even know what to do with my computer at that point. But he figured it out. And by the age of 10, he was building computers and was working in the back room of a business called Computer Concepts, building computers and putting safety, whatever you would call it, protection, antivirus protection on people's computers.
Oh, wow.
As a little kid. So we knew he was smart, but school was a nightmare for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that right there is the origin of my, that the idea that if what I'm talking about isn't making sense to Tommy and doesn't work with Tommy, I need to think differently about it. And so it was on, and this is a long first answer, I'm sorry, but
no, that's what this is what the medium here is for, that we have space for the answers to go where they need to go and for it to be organic and conversational.
Great, great. Well, when I was taking Tommy to these different places, for some reason I wasn't that worried about him. By the way, Tommy's my son's name. I just gave it up. And now he's a front-end designer for Rhino, doing all kind of coding and internet stuff I would never understand. And he lives in his own place in Grand Rapids. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's something we couldn't have imagined at the time. But I wasn't that worried about it. But when I was at the occupational therapist and physical therapist, I met tired parents and lonely kids.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I thought, okay, something needs to be done about this. So while I'm at Princeton in a, Karl Barth German reading group with Daryl Guter, most of the time, then I'm coming home to Virginia and I'm starting up this ministry that originally in my head was two young people with disabilities. That's what I thought of originally, that these people need something and I can provide it. That was my thinking. I didn't know them very well yet. So I didn't understand the gifts that they had. So what happened was I was at one of these things with Tommy.
I think you said something there that maybe would be worth coming back to, and just maybe articulate a little more something profound that you were saying. You had an idea of something you were going to do, but you didn't get to, you didn't know them yet. You didn't know the gifts that they offered yet. We might be jumping ahead in the story, but I want to hear that a little here, and then you can come back to the origin story.
Yeah. You know what? I'll tell you what, let me come to that in a second. We'll put a pin in it right there. And you've noted that that's an important thing. And I'm going to tell you how that all got turned around for me.
Okay.
So what happened was, there was a young lady whose mother was really upset because this young lady was having a birthday party at an aquatic center, a pirate themed party, and nobody was coming because she just didn't have many friends. She didn't know how to explain it to her. She was visibly upset. And I said, okay, wait a second. You know, my wife and I coached the neighborhood swim team. Go ahead and have the party. We're going to find some people to bring to the party. So we got some of the people on our swim team. Some were Christians, some weren't Christians. We took them to the dollar store and had them buy things that were piratey themed or aquatic themed. We went to the aquatic center and we had this party, and it was a great party. Probably had, I don't know, 7 or 8 kids I got to show up, and then the young girl and the mother. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that the mother was just smiling the whole time, almost crying. The young girl was just having so much fun being the center of attention. And then the young people I brought, well, I saw something different in them that I hadn't seen before. They really leaned into caring for this young girl. And now that they had a shared experience with her, when they saw her at school, they had a different relationship. So having had a shared experience and seeing that, okay, this person's more than someone who goes to a special ed classroom. It's a person with interests and desires and gifts. They saw this person differently. And I thought, okay, wait a second, you know, let's keep doing this. And so I started a ministry. And originally, like I said, it was a ministry that was trying to address this loneliness. It was a ministry to people with disabilities where I would recruit typically developing people as volunteer leaders to develop a program and develop relationships with people with intellectual developmental disabilities, people who are marginalized, in hopes of creating a community. Still, it was ministry to and ministry for people with disabilities. And now here's where it changed. We took a camping trip, and I took in my van, I had one volunteer leader and like six guys with me. And one of those guys was a guy named Bo. And Bo, I don't know what degree he can read, but he always had a Harry Potter book. I know that he loved watching Friends because he would constantly talk to them as if they were there with us. You know, no, Chandler, that's not funny, Chandler. You know, stuff like that.
That's okay. Yeah.
and he's really a gentle presence who doesn't like to be in the center of things, who has a lot of feelings, very thoughtful, kind guy. But he wasn't himself for this trip because there had been a death in his family and he really hadn't been away from home without his family members. And so he was sad and he was a little nervous. And I was still getting to know him and didn't know how to deal with that. Fortunately, there was another person on the trip. His name is Craig, and I talk to Craig regularly still. And this was 20 years ago or something like that. Craig is a self-described redneck. He loves NASCAR. If you ask him, he'll say, I love Dale Jr. Dale Jr. Anytime Virginia Tech is playing a sport, he knows I went there to college, so he'll send me updates on the scores, which is a little depressing the last few years, but the way we connect. March Madness, he's asking me, who are you picking and all that. We have a great, fun relationship. Anytime I go into Williamsburg, I make sure I go visit him. He also has cerebral palsy and an intellectual disability from being in his mother's womb when she was in a car accident. He's had a dorsal rhizotomy, which is a surgery to stop spasticity. He's been through occupational therapy, vision therapy, all kinds of therapies in special education. And he was at this camp. Okay, now here's what happened. Here's what happened at the camp. Here's where everything changed for me. There was a time at the camp where there'd be some music and then there'd be some sort of message, some sort of gospel message that was supposed to be accessible to all the people who are at the camp. Very embodied, a lot of illustrations, that sort of thing. So I thought, okay, I'm going to ask the people leading this if they will play the theme song from Friends. Because mm-hmm. I know if they do that, then my friend Bo will be really excited. Because we've been at the camp 4 days now, and he's not eating much. All he does is sit in the shower or sit. This place had a hot tub. Warm water, warmth, and water just seemed to calm him down. That's the only thing that made him happy. Other than that, he was sad. So I thought, okay, let's do this. You know, if they play this song, I bet this will get him involved. So we're heading over there to the room where you have the building where you have this event. And as we're going, one of my students who's on the autism spectrum just takes off into the George Washington National Forest. I said, okay, wait, you know, I said to the volunteer leader, I said, please go get him and I'll meet you back at the club room. And I'm walking, trying to shepherd everybody else there. And I would get some other responsible leader to watch my guys. And then I'd go help this guy collect Xavier, who was the runner. Mm-hmm. But I realized when I got there, I was missing Bo. You know, the whole reason I was setting up this thing is like to make Bo feel better. So I was like, okay, I better go find Bo. So I go back to the dorm, to the shower, and Bo's not there. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I go to the hot tub. And as I'm walking towards the hot tub, I see, you know, a shoe, a sock, a shirt, some shorts, some boxer shorts. And then I see Bo in the hot tub completely naked. Fortunately, I find a towel, wrap it around him, get him back to our dorm. And this is where I start to apply my skill set to the situation. I'm a father with a child with a disability. So I draw on that wisdom and it doesn't work. But I have a Master of Divinity, one of the most arrogant degree titles ever. Where I learned how to be a non-anxious presence. Right. In my pastoral care course. The problem is, like, they didn't really teach you how to do that when you're anxious. And I was really anxious. So that didn't work. I was a defense away from a dissertation, which was then going to, you know, spawn my second book, which was Amplifying Our Witness, which was the first book on youth ministry and disability. So I had all that wisdom, the academic sort of wisdom, and I tried to apply that to the situation. And now Bo's crying harder. And honestly, I'm about to cry, and I wish it were out of empathy, but it was out of frustration. At this moment, Craig walks into the room. He walks a little off kilter, you know. He doesn't analyze the situation and say, Bo seems to be in distress and my friend Ben isn't doing a good job at comforting him. Perhaps I can help. You know, he's not going through that. He doesn't have this sort of capacity of abstraction to analyze the situation, but he responds immediately to the situation by getting in between me and Bo, putting his arm around Bo, and Bo rests his head on his shoulder and stops crying. And they're friends to this date. And it changed Bo's experience at camp. And the thing that it changed for me was, oh my goodness, the body of Christ has cerebral palsy. The body of Christ has Down syndrome. This isn't ministry to people with disabilities. This is ministry by people with disabilities. I hadn't seen Craig as someone who has gifts for ministry, who in his baptism is ordained in a sense, you know, the baptism is a kind of ordination for ministry, that he has gifts that need a place to be used and he needs to be affirmed in these gifts. And at that moment right there, our whole ministry model changed to a discipleship model where I'm training young people with intellectual developmental disabilities to use their gifts. And that is the seed of what became Disabling Mission, Enabling Witness. Mm. My whole missiology was being challenged, because while I was studying academic missiology at an incredible institution, I was having the lived experience of seeing things happen that haven't been written anywhere. Nobody's been talking about it. No, mm-hmm. Nobody's imagination has included Craig as a missionary, mm-hmm. right. or as a preacher, or as an evangelist. It just hadn't happened. And so I thought, I have to amplify the witness of these folks so people can see it. And that was amplifying our witness. And then mm-hmm. as I reflected more deeply on that, I thought, this needs to change the way we think about missiology. And so that's where Disabling Mission, Enabling Witness came from.
Thank you for listening to Blind Faith. Now, a word from our sponsor. Are you ready to hear who's sponsoring this podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever been to the Mall of America?
No.
Have you ever wanted to be the Mall of America?
No. Yes.
Oh.
Okay, one yes, one no. But what if I told you DeLeo Brothers Pizza? Okay.
I changed my answer.
One of the best pizzas in all of Minnesota, as voted by the people that vote for that. And here's their slogan. In garlic, we crust.
Oh.
Now you want to go to the Mall of America, don't you?
I'm going to the Mall of America right now.
Let's take a flight.
And they have a second location opening in Seattle. So look it up on this thing called Google. And DeLeo Brothers Pizza, bringing you Blind Faith Podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. This is where I want to just... There's that muscle in me that still is there. Oh, define terms. What is missiology? Well, let's just say nobody has great definitions on missiology, but it expands the way we understand God's work in this world. We'll just say that we haven't had that imagination until people with a lived experience like you just articulated could then say, hey, let's bring this experience into the conversation on God's work in this world and how we participate with that and who participates with that, and maybe who has been disabled from participating in that. And I think that takes me to one of the other questions, and I'm probably jumping out of order here because there's a number of things that I think would be helpful for our listeners to hear that you've brought to this. But I'm going to just jump out of order, and I really liked how you used the word disabling mission in the title, but just how you bring that out in the work as well. And could you give a couple thoughts to how you got to that way of seeing it in Disabling Mission, Enabling Witness?
Yeah. So the way I'm using disabling, I'd never seen it used anywhere like that before. I saw disabling educational inequalities. I did a whole lot of reading in education in general, and how disability education was thought of. Did a lot of reading in disability studies. But I was trying to come up with a term, a way of using a term that was disability is a positive a move. Because as soon as you say dis, you think of sort of a negative sort of situation. And so people would say, you know, if the car's not working, the car's disabled, that sort of a thing. And so people's mindset goes to the negative. And what I was trying to do is say it's a positive task of removing ableist biases. Now, what is ableism? So I would say disableism, you know, would be discrimination against people with disabilities that's explicit. And you just don't see much of that anymore. I mean, it's out there, but societies move such that you have people with disabilities and various roles in societies, and there's discourse around it, including mental health issues, where it's hard to get away with that. Ableism endures. It's structural. Ableism is the idea that the world is set up for a certain kind of body-mind. And so any body mind that doesn't hit these standards is filtered out, or that person has to become a life hacker, an expert life hacker, to navigate life in a world that's not designed for them. So one project I had that led into Disabling Mission Enabling Witness was a project called Disabling Theological Education. So I thought, how do we take ableist biases away from theological education? Mm-hmm. And that could be doctrinally. Like when I studied the image of God, I found nothing on disability that was positive. The image of God was articulated and constructed in theological conversations in ways that either didn't consider disability or that dismissed it as, you know, a derivation from a good or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it could be doctrinally. It could be doctrinally in terms of our eschatology or how we view what our body is going to be like in the afterlife. Mm-hmm. That what do? We just take it, it's almost like Firebox Superman. You take the best sort of vision of a normate ideal sort of person and make it super that.
Yeah.
Which, right. Yeah, right?
And I
so it could be
wrestle with that too. Well, what's the perfected body? What's the, like, what year was I that body? Or what, which, or like, does it make it like any sense when we start to actually interrogate that question of perfected body and all that stuff? So right.
Perfected for what, right?
Mm-hmm.
To what end? Yeah. So that's a problem with our theological anthropology. What does it mean to be a human before the face of God? If we don't really know what a human's for in terms of its destiny and purpose, then it's easy to say that it should be this sort of a way. So then the theology then is mapped onto the ministry practice. Who can be the evangelist? Someone with a presence and a strong voice and great teaching skills. Okay. Well, you've just excluded all kind of people. Typically, historically, people imagine a man up there as well. And so my friend Chris Klein, who's a motorized wheelchair user with cerebral palsy, he speaks with a augmented speech device using only his left big toe.
Mm.
You know, you have to enter into a different kind of a time to have a conversation with him. You have to create the space in which he can respond and you can have a true dialogue. Now, he went through an ordination process. And when it came time for ordination, he was asked the question, how do you think you're going to be a pastor? And the very question betrayed all kinds of assumptions about who can be a pastor and demonstrated a real lack of theological imagination around vocation.
Mm-hmm.
So disabling, the project I'm doing in disabling then requires centering folks who have been marginalized and for theological education, who've been marginalized in the curricula, who haven't been represented. It means having more people at your seminary who claim disability as part of how they understand themselves in the world. Because as you know, I mean, you would have a different reading of certain scriptures than I would have just because of your life experience.
Right.
So our embodiment affects our hermeneutics, our interpretations of things, doctrines and scriptures. And that's all part of disabling theological education as well. And so that's the term disabling. I'm trying to say, what is it? It's to remove ableist biases from X.
Yeah, that was really helpful. And I think it provokes thinking of, wait, how have we allowed these biases into the thing? And so, yeah, it was really interesting, in so many ways to think in terms of who is, quote, able to serve, who is able to be a pastor, who is able to, and then when you bring it to mission, who is able to witness, is it only the special ones or whatever ways, or I never wrote it in my work, but the idea of how much bang can we get for our buck, because it's so much about the economics of who we support and how we support them. We could probably talk on a lot of things, but I think these stories have really helped articulate what I'm about, and have answered some of the other questions I have. But one thing that is personal to me, and maybe others will be interested too, is in the early pages of Disabling Mission, Enabling Witness, was, and you touched on some of the other really profound things, the image of God and theological education and so on. But I really got excited because you talked about, yeah, there's other works out there, people with disabilities, but even in the work you did, but with people with disability, but the works from a first person perspective, and maybe since 2018, there's been something that I missed, but that got me excited to do the work I was doing, to go into disability studies, mission, so on. It was hard almost for a little bit because, like I said, I don't want to be labeled. These were the reflections that I don't be that guy on the periphery, but then it became something that, like, wait, this, like you mentioned, it allows me to see Scripture in a new light because this has been my experience. This is the things that bring to light what God's been saying to me and my experience. So I'm just curious, as you've reflected, maybe leading into that comment and leading and since then, the idea of first person perspective and mission with people with disabilities or disabled people, and mission and doing some robust theological reflection. Could you speak to that some more?
Yeah. So most of what I've written, it's because nothing was out there, right?
Yeah.
And I'm growing more hesitant to write in this area because I feel like there are more people with disabilities who are having opportunities for higher education, mm-hmm. and who are longing to be part of this discourse, but their voices are missing for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes voices are missing. And if a voice is missing, it's not missing like, you know, my keys were missing because I misplaced them. There are always agents that are stopping voices. Mm-hmm. You know, vocation mm-hmm. comes from this whole idea of vox, right? The calling. Our vocation is a calling, but it also is it's a calling to use our voice, however defined, you know, our influence to exercise agency. And so I want to see more works by people with disabilities engaging in these conversations. And so as a result, through the Center for Disability Ministry, we have a co-branded series with InterVarsity Press Academic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the co-editor with John Swinton of this series, who some, I don't know if your folks will know John. I imagine they will.
We hope so.
If not, maybe you can have him on here at some point.
We're working on that. So,
but anyways, he's one of the leading disability theologians in the world. He's done all kind of creative work. So this series is all about amplifying and platforming people with disabilities to speak about whatever they want to speak about as it relates to practical theology. And if the so, for example, our first book in the series was tri-authored, to mm-hmm. use the trialogue thing you talked about at the beginning, tri-authored by three folks, practitioners and scholars who all claim disability. And the title of it was Disabling Leadership.
Right,
so it's building
right.
on mm-hmm. the concept of disabling that I had sort of lifted up. But then they are talking about their own experience as leaders and obstacles they've faced and the possibilities of reimagining leadership in ecclesial and peri-ecclesial settings, parachurch settings, as a person with a disability. So that's the first book. The next book in the series, which should come out soon, is by Rochelle Schuerman of Wheaton, and it's on evangelism and disability. And while she herself doesn't claim disability, she has disabled children and centers the voices of people with disabilities in her work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next book in the series, and this is my direct sort of connection to it, even though I'm the editor of the series with John. Mm-hmm. John and I are co-authoring a book called Missing Voices in Disability Theology, where we set up the whole concept of why voices are missing. We talk about a practical theology and ethnography and set the stage. And then we invite people who either their voices are missing from discourse because I just did finger quotes, which there's no way you could, that wasn't terribly helpful. Missing from disability theology because they use augmented speech perhaps, or they're missing because of an onset diagnosis where they lost their platform for exercising their voice in leadership. And so they're talking about this whole idea of what does it mean to have a voice? What does it mean to have a vocation? And so that's where I find myself now. I'll still write about disability, but it won't be the center point of what I'm writing about. I want to create conceptual space and literary space for people with disabilities to speak to their own experiences and to enrich the theological conversation with the perspectives that they bring. So, for example, I am writing a book on harmony with horses with my wife. That's about therapeutic horsemanship. I'm working on a work on bodybuilding, actually, theology of bodybuilding and fitness. And part of what I'll look at is critiquing the whole idea that there is an ideal or normate body. And I'll interview bodybuilders with disabilities who are tired of being other people's inspiration and want to be respected as athletes in their own right. And so disability is going to be with me forever as a critical lens I use to challenge the ableism of the world. And I can't do that without relationships like the relationship we have, a friendship where we presented at this Society of Missiology together and you invited me into that.
Yeah.
You know, but those, I have to have these relationships in order to have any integrity in speaking into this. And I'm realizing that more and more as I move on in my academic career, my primary role needs to be platforming rather than being the one who speaks into it myself.
Well, and that's where the integrity for the word amplifying in your work, I think, comes out of your own experience, which circles back to one of our like mottos here is all scholarship is biography, and that you would be on the one hand amplifying could be criticized because the voice is already there and the spirit is the one who amplifies it and it's really just being drowned out by others, but the integrity you bring to using that word is because you're helping to remove barriers that are there. So I'm grateful for hearing how you, in this conversation, were able to connect dots to your story, your experience, and then the questions that you asked. I think it's so profound that you're like reading all about image of God, and like, okay, where is anything positive written here about disability or some of the questions you had in theological education? Like, we probably don't have time to really get into it, but the questions of how we do education in a certain rational, linear way and the different pedagogy that maybe could be brought into our colleges and theological education institutions would be really fascinating for further reading. I point them to your work there on disabling mission, enabling witness. But I just want to thank you for coming and sharing your voice into this conversation. I have some others in the room with me, but I think we're running to the end of our time. So I just want to ask if you have any final thoughts as you think about disability theology, disability in the church. Is there just anything you'd like us to walk away with?
Well, I'd say it's an ongoing conversation, and a lot of people don't enter into it because they're afraid they'll say the wrong thing. And
wait, let me hear some feedback from the others in the room here. Does that sound like one reason people might not enter into this? People might be afraid to not say the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think 100%, especially, hi, Dr. Connor, this is Salma. I'm one of the undergrad students in here, especially as someone who's like in a classroom setting. I think there's always kind of certain topics, even when you talk about ministry and leadership, that we kind of like to shy away from because we're just scared of saying the wrong thing. So it's just honestly has been just so nice to just hear from you and just learn from you. And even for me to just prompt so many different questions, as I'm learning so much about ministry and leadership in this season of my life.
Wonderful. That's wonderful.
I would add too, this is Paige speaking, by the way. I would add that, I think our tendency, I'm a professor here at the university and I also work in full-time ministry. And I think our natural kind of response to seeing a need is trying to resolve it or address it or, you know, create a ministry for it or, you know, serve people in a specific way. And, your approach and kind of the language about, you know, not ministering to people, but ministering with people and then also empowering, mm-hmm. you know, people who are, you know, different kinds of learners and thinkers and processors to, I think, co-labor in ministry, I think, is really inspiring and challenging. And I think that's maybe I could speak for some who maybe are slower to speak into, you know, the disability community in a ministry sense, is because I think our response is to sort of like not fix it, but I know that is a, you know, it's kind of like a taboo way of approaching it, but it, you know, we want to help, we want to fix and resolve and strengthen. And that maybe historically hasn't shown to be even, you know, the right approach or asking the right questions or thinking of, you know, people in that way.
No, absolutely. And, you know, my original story about my motivations for getting into this kind of ministry are not, don't make me look good in that regard, but you got to start somewhere, right? Yeah. And, you know, whereas I went in with one mindset, it's the relationships that change everything. So I would say that the more relationships you have with different folks with different embodiments and different minds and different ways of being in the world, well, that's enriching and it'll make you a more curious and potentially more loving person.
Mm-hmm. Well, I cut you off as you were saying that it's an ongoing conversation, but I thought that was worth interrupting for the sake of underscoring that idea that many are afraid to jump into the conversation. So I know you were saying a little bit more than just that. So if you want to finish your thought, if it's even still there.
Oh, who knows where that thought is. It's okay.
Well,
it's with all the other thoughts somewhere.
Well, I just,
this has been a delightful conversation and thank you so much for hosting this kind of conversation. They're very important. I think you would love to have a conversation with my colleague, Dr. Carlos Thompson.
Yes. So I got to figure that timing out with him, but yes, yes, Carlos would be a great voice in this this series. So, well, just thank you so much for coming, and we honor you in this, and just thank you for the work you're doing, and also that you've been doing writing on this, so others can engage it and learn language that will help them and sensibilities. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
God bless. Story really came out in that one. Mm-hmm. A little times I wanted to cry. So I don't know where you guys were on that.
He had mentioned something when he was, I don't know if he was in an organization or he had shown up to, you know, sort of like class or something, but he had mentioned like just these like exhausted parents and lonely kids. And I think,
the occupational therapy, the waiting rooms is really where he was talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then like the party and the girl not coming or, you know, the girl not having the friends. And I think just there, it's a whole nother layer to the conversation of things that I think are so easily overlooked. But again, you don't know unless you hear the stories and you're in those spaces and you can see the lives lived and that sort of weariness that, you know, parenting brings. I think, you know, for parents and families that aren't facing, you know, really significant things with their kids. So I thought that was really just thought-provoking, convicting.
Yeah, and maybe I'll be kind to his own reflection of, well, that's not, doesn't reflect well on me that I had this thought of, I will bring something to help them, ministry to them, and not realizing there's a gift that they bring. Mm-hmm. But it's a starting point, being willing to enter into something that maybe feels like, whoa. And there's probably a lot of people that are in the occupational therapy room and might go and they don't see that there's a space that they could enter into, and so that's just a willingness to enter into that. It's the first step, and then God will continue to move you as you keep that curiosity. I liked that word that he used, that as we engage in these things, there will be a new curiosity, and there was a certain empathy that he demonstrated in his stories of, I saw this and I saw this, and I like he could see how people are perceiving things a certain way. So that's super important piece to bring into it. If you bring those places in, the mistakes that happen, that you don't say the right thing, or that those things get washed away as you participate and learn from the mistakes that you might make early on. What other comments jumped out to you that you want to highlight?
Yeah, he said something kind of along the lines of that basically everybody has gifts essentially to like build the church, and I just think that's so important, especially for me, and just knowing that I definitely feel a calling into youth ministry, and even just thinking about just creating that space, I think, for people to use their gifts, and that everybody does have those gifts. Just how cool is it that we all get to work together, that we all get to have one mission. Even if we are different, we bring different experiences, different stories, different capacities, whatever it might be. But it's just really cool it would be really cool to see just a church where everybody gets to use their giftings for one mission. So I just thought that was cool. I thought that's something that definitely I'm going to be reflecting on for the next couple of days for sure.
Yeah, for sure. The church, like, there's a common refrain in mission studies is the whole church taking the whole gospel to the whole world. And I think the disability and mission or disability and evangelism kind of critique is like, okay, but what about this part of the church? And and so if there's a sense to see that there's the gospel is at work for all, like the power of the gospel isn't only for particular people but for all. And then all can participate in sharing the gospel. it creates a another way of seeing the church, and it just connects to so many places that the imagery in the body of Christ, mm-hmm. those that seem weaker to the body, who says that they're weaker? Like it's Paul's underscoring that it's somebody thinks this. It's not necessarily what God would say, but somebody might say that this person might be, but they're indispensable. Like that, yeah. that sense of, they're not, it's not just, well, they are an additive to the body, but they're not supplemental to the body, but indispensable.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of underscores some of what you're saying with a church where all participate and in youth ministry and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Paige, I loved it when you jumped in with your comment, and now I'm totally forgetting what you jumped in to say that was meaningful to you when you were sharing a few minutes ago.
In the interview?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It was just based on the question of like, you know, is there a sense of like being afraid to say something or afraid to sort of ask questions?
Yeah.
I was saying that in most times in ministry, like
you
want to like respond to a need and you know, minister and see, you know, just I think aid and support and help and strengthen and that can be I think it can be like you were saying, it can be helpful, certainly. And making things accessible and making, I think,
if we're always learning,
yeah,
as we're always like revising mm-hmm. what our approach is, that we don't stay stuck to, well, we said this is how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. But we're always learning, like, okay, we can come in with flawed motives maybe, mm-hmm. and God can refine mm-hmm. that in us. Yeah. But it does speak to how we approach disability. And I'm glad you said what you said, and I'm not picking on you, but like we want to fix, and you knew right away, like, wait, that's taboo language, but
yeah.
It speaks to how we see, quote, the other, and I'll do the finger quotes too, that don't work in a medium like this, but
yeah.
we quote unquote want to fix, and we see things as broken or in need of a cure, and so we are, and I think one of the things that we can take it out of only the quote unquote disability conversation, but whatever ministry we have, we can sometimes say, oh, I see a problem and I'm going to come fix the problem.
Right. Wow.
Whether or not the people there are saying that's a problem they need fixing.
Right.
Yeah.
And are they feeling served, or are they just feeling like patronized, or like the paternalism that we can often have in the church as we try and help those that are in need. And so finding ways to have a participatory sense that those that we're serving are feeling served and receiving the gospel. And that, so as well as the reciprocity, mm-hmm. which I think maybe he didn't get to say as much, but that we start to see we're not like the saviors. Sometimes we're being saved in the process of our ministering, that like it's revealing things in us that need to be refined and purified. And,
yeah.
and so, there's a reciprocity in a ministry where we see people have gifts, and the gifts might be surprising in the way we would imagine them until we get in the moment and see these things played out in mutuality and interdependence and community. So, yeah, I thought that was really good. Any last thought from either of you?
I think my final kind of thought was, it was interesting that both Dr. Young and Dr. Connor had mentioned how, you know, at one point there were, you know, very few voices in the disability theology space, and now there's more and more coming to be, and how they're, you know, both sort of, you know, electively or intentionally kind of removing their voice or their kind of contribution to it. I just am kind of wondering how that would, like, is there like an advocacy element to the contributions by people like them? Oh, I guess.
Well, one of the ways that they've been doing more of that is by editing books mm-hmm. and works and being in a space where they can advocate for these voices being published because they have a voice that editors and publishers would listen to. Mm-hmm. So there is an advocacy that they bring to the conversation.
Cool.
I would think there could also be other ways of advocacy, and I'm not an expert in this, mm-hmm. but there would be ways, maybe not just to advocate, but to come alongside people and mm-hmm. say, hey, how can we help you? And so that's like what he was mentioning with one of the projects he's working on with John Swinton, Missing Voices, where...
Yeah, sounds incredible.
And all of that flows out of, like, it's not something that can happen tomorrow mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. any of us here. It happens because they've spent decades in the ministry of working with people with disability, and then in their places where they teach, where they're getting to have people with disabilities study with them and so on.
Yeah.
And so then they can, out of those relationships, help bring space for their voice to be heard. So advocacy for sure, especially over years of building relationships. So I think the other thing would just be building relationships so that then where maybe it's not a book, but hey, I'm doing a youth camp, Salma or something like, and one day, and hey, how can I have the voice of somebody who is maybe not the usual voice mm-hmm. on the platform, yeah. and how can they be somewhere where they can minister in this space too, or mm-hmm. that you can see spaces for that over time as the Lord uses your voices, you can bring other voices in with you.
Yeah, that's good.
So, another conversation in our series on disability theology, Blind Faith, I think the thing we heard here is that imagination, like there just wasn't an imagination in pastoral theology for this, or an imagination for this, that sometimes we have blind spots. So let's just leave that with all the layers that could be there with that comment. And so just want to thank you for being with us for another conversation in Blind Faith, and we will be back at it again. This has been another episode of Blind Faith. Enjoy having you with us, and come stick around. If you like this one, give us a click like, and whatever platform you're on, give us a rating, and go ahead and subscribe. We're glad you're here with us. We'll be with you again soon.